I didn't think much when Shane invited me over that night. It was supposed to be a regular sleepover, a chance to escape homework and siblings. Her family was welcoming, as always. Her mom cooked dinner, her dad joked about school, and her sisters teased us about boys. The house felt warm and alive, but Shane seemed off. She kept glancing at her phone during dinner, her fingers trembling slightly.
"Sean's coming,"
she finally whispered after we went upstairs. Her words hung in the air, heavy and unspoken. I'd met her brother once or twice, and something about him always felt wrong. His presence was suffocating, like he brought his storm cloud with him.
"Why?"
I asked.
"He wants money. Dad's going to say no."
She didn't have to say the rest. I didn't push her, but I remembered the rumors about him. People in town said Sean wasn't right. He had a temper, a way of looking at you like he was planning something you wouldn't like. It was after midnight when his car pulled into the driveway. Shane's body tensed.
"Why is he here so late?"
I asked.
"He wants money. He always does. It's never enough."
We heard the front door slam, then Sean's voice, loud, angry, and unsettling.
"I told you I need it!"
he yelled. Michael's voice replied, calm but firm.
"Not this time, Sean. You think you can cut me off?"
Sean roared.
"I'm part of this family!"
Shane stood up, her hands shaking.
"I need to see what's happening. Don't!"
I whispered, grabbing her arm, but she pulled away. From the hallway, I peeked out and saw her at the top of the stairs. Her parents stood below, blocking Sean's path. The rifle appeared abruptly, too quickly to process. The first shot echoed through the house, and Michael crumpled, blood pooling around him.
"Mike!"
Sandra screamed, rushing to him.
"Please, Sean, don't!"
she begged, her voice breaking. The second shot hit her in the chest, throwing her back against the stairs. She tumbled, her body landing awkwardly at the bottom.
"Mom!"
Shane screamed. Sean's head snapped up, his face twisted with rage.
"Run!"
I hissed, backing into her room and diving under the bed. Heavy boots stomped up the stairs.
"Where are you, Shane?"
Sean called out, his voice sing-song. I pressed myself against the wall, and my breath caught in my throat. Through the gap under the bed, I could see his boots, blood dripping from the soles, pacing the hallway.
"You think you're better than me?"
he growled.
"I'm the one who should be in charge. Me!"
A scream erupted from downstairs. "Sheena!"
"Stay away!"
she shrieked. Her voice was cut short by another gunshot. The footsteps returned. The door to Shane's room creaked open. His boots stepped inside, leaving crimson stains on the carpet.
"Where's my little sis, Shane?"
he called out. I peeked through the crack and saw her. She was in the corner, crouched in the closet, the glow of her phone lighting her face.
"Help us!"
she sobbed into the phone.
"Please!"
The closet door flew open.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
Sean barked, grabbing the phone and slamming it right beside her face.
"Calling the cops, eh?"
he sneered.
"Sean, stop! Please, you don't have to do this!"
Shane begged, tears streaming down her face.
"Is that so?"
His voice dropped to a chilling whisper.
"You don't tell me what to do!"
He grabbed her by the hair, dragging her out of the closet. Shane clawed at his hand, kicking and screaming.
"Please, Sean, I'm your sister. We're your family."
He froze, tilting his head. Then he laughed, a low, guttural sound that sent chills through me.
"Family!"
he spat, raising his bloodied boot.
"Then taste the blood of the family!"
He stomped his boot into her face, forcing her head back. Shane gagged, choking as blood spilled from her mouth.
"Shut up!"
he roared, his voice echoing off the walls. He pressed harder, slamming her head into the floor, her cries muffled by the weight of his boot. I clenched my fists, tears streaming down my face, trying to muffle my own sobs. Finally, he stepped back and raised the rifle, aiming at her head.
"No, please!"
She screamed. The shot rang out, and blood splattered across the wall. Shane's body slumped lifelessly to the floor, her head at an unnatural angle. Sean crouched over her, tilting his head, as if admiring his artwork. "You stay quiet." I stayed frozen, unable to move, the bloodied floor etched into my mind. When the paramedics pulled me out from under the bed hours later, I couldn't speak. I couldn't even cry. I told no one who I was. The evidence was enough to convict him, but every night I see her face, hear her voice, and feel the weight of my terror. And I'll never stop hearing Sean's laughter, cold and endless. The Sean Bentler murder case occurred in 2006 in Bonaparte, Iowa, when 22-year-old Sean Bentler killed his parents, Michael and Sandra, and his three younger sisters, aged 17, 14, and 12. Bentler shot his family with a rifle in an attempt to inherit the family's wealth and take control of their successful grain business. The crime was uncovered when one of the sisters called 911 during the attack, identifying Sean as the killer. He was arrested shortly after and convicted of 5 counts of first-degree murder. Bentler was sentenced to life in prison without parole, leaving a community devastated. I woke up to the rotten smell. That smell, it clung to everything. My skin, my clothes, even my hair. It was like the house was alive, breathing misery into every corner. My stomach growled, but I knew better than to ask for food. Asking meant punishment. I sat up in bed, or what you'd call a bed. It was more like a filthy mattress with springs poking through. Around me, my brothers and sisters were motionless, some still chained to their bed frames. Mom stormed into the room, cigarette in hand.
"Get up,"
she snapped, her voice like a slap. She walked over and grabbed me by the arm. Her nails dug into my skin as she dragged me to the bathroom.
"Look at you,"
she spat, shoving me toward the mirror. My reflection stared back, hollow cheeks, sunken eyes, bruises painting my body like some sick artwork.
"You think you're better than me?"
She grinned, a cruel twist of her lips.
"Let's fix that."
The cigarette burned as she pressed it into my shoulder. I bit my lip so hard I tasted blood. Crying out only made her angrier.
"You're nothing, Jordan,"
she whispered, before walking out, leaving me trembling in the cold bathroom. I stepped into the shower, letting the icy water hit my skin. The cigarette burn stung, but the water helped numb it. I closed my eyes and let out a shaky breath. "One day, I'll get out of here. One day." Then I heard it, a low chuckle. My eyes shot open, and I turned to see him, Dad, leaning in the doorway, his eyes dark, lips twisted in a grin that made my stomach churn.
"You're growing up,"
he said, voice dripping with something that made my skin crawl.
"Get out!"
I screamed, my voice echoing off the bathroom walls. He didn't move. That grin just grew wider. I grabbed the door and slammed it shut, hearing the sickening crunch of his nose breaking on the other side. His screams followed, then a string of curses. My heart raced. I'd done it now. Footsteps thundered down the hall. "Mom." The door burst open, splinters flying everywhere. They dragged me out by my hair, their hands rough and unrelenting. My screams didn't matter. Nothing did.
"You think you're smart?"
Mom snarled, slapping me so hard my ears rang. Dad laughed, holding a cloth to his bleeding nose. Together, they beat me until I couldn't move. Then they threw me into the attic, slamming the door shut behind them. The attic was worse than usual that night. The stench of urine made it impossible to breathe deeply. The darkness wasn't empty. It was alive, filled with my siblings' muffled cries and the sound of my own labored breathing. Hours passed. I didn't sleep. "I can't live like this anymore," I thought, staring at the bobby pin I'd hidden in my sleeve days ago. The lock on the attic door wasn't impossible to pick. I'd watched Dad enough times to know. I crawled down the stairs, every creak of the old wood echoing in the silent house. The living room was a maze of filth. old plates with maggots, piles of unwashed clothes, and the faint hum of Dad's CPAP machine in the next room. I reached my 13-year-old sister's room. Her eyes widened as I shook her awake.
"We're leaving,"
I whispered. She nodded, her face pale but determined. Together, we crept to the front door, avoiding the spots on the floor we knew would squeak. When we reached the porch, she froze.
I can't,
she whispered, tears streaming down her face.
If they catch me,
her voice cracked.
You go. You have to go. No.
I begged, grabbing her arm, but she pulled away, stepping back into the darkness of the house. I turned and ran. The street was silent, the world outside feeling like a dream. My bare feet slapped against the pavement as I raced down the street, adrenaline numbing the sharp stones cutting into my skin. Every shadow felt like a monster, every gust of wind a whisper telling me to turn back. When I saw the flashing red and blue lights of the police car, I collapsed to my knees, sobbing. A cop stepped out, his face a mix of confusion and concern.
Please, help us.
The next hour was chaos. Half an hour later, sirens blared outside the house. I stood at the edge of the street, watching as the cops stormed in. The screams of my parents pierced the air.
What are you doing? You can't do this!
As I watched my parents being dragged away in handcuffs, a strange calm settled over me. The Turpin House of Horrors case came to light in 2018 when 17-year-old Jordan Turpin escaped her Paris, California home and called 911, exposing years of abuse by her parents, David and Louise Turpin. Authorities discovered 13 siblings, aged 2 to 29, malnourished and living in squalor, some shackled to their beds. The children endured severe neglect, starvation, and isolation, deprived of education and medical care. The parents were arrested and later sentenced to life in prison for torture, false imprisonment, and child abuse. The case shocked the world, highlighting failures in oversight and the resilience of the children who survived. The summer of 2002 was a time of freedom and lightheartedness for me. School was out, and at 15, I was enjoying the lazy rhythm of South Carolina life. On that particular June afternoon, I was at my best friend's house, helping her with some chores. The air was warm, carrying the scent of freshly cut grass, and laughter came easily between us as we filled watering cans and chatted about the plans we'd made for the weekend. Life felt normal, safe. Then, the car pulled up. It wasn't anything unusual at first, an old sedan rolling to a stop nearby. I didn't pay much attention until the driver got out and started walking toward me. He was nondescript, just an average guy, maybe in his 30s or 40s, with short hair and a calm demeanor. In his hands, he held some brochures, the kind you'd hand out to neighbors or leave in mailboxes.
"Hey," he said, smiling. "Mind if I give you one of these? They're just for a local thing I'm working on."
I was polite, nodding and taking the brochure without really looking at it. He made small talk, nothing strange, just asking if we lived here and if we liked the area. His tone was casual, friendly even. And then, without warning, he pulled out a gun.
"Get in,"
he ordered, pointing to a large storage bin in the back seat of his car. His voice dropped, ice cold. My heart raced, but my legs moved. I climbed into the bin, and he slammed the lid shut. He took me to an apartment complex. It looked so ordinary, just rows of brick buildings. But dread gripped my chest. No one saw us as he shoved me inside. The apartment smelled like bleach and stale air. He led me to the bedroom, where the blinds were drawn so tight no light could sleep in. His eyes had changed now, colder, calculating. He locked the door, and the nightmare began.
"Let's make this memorable,"
he said, pulling out a small, sharp knife from his pocket. I froze, unable to breathe as he approached. He forced me to kneel on the floor, his hand gripping my arm so tightly it felt like my bones might snap.
"I want you to remember me forever,"
he muttered. The blade pressed against my skin, and he began to carve. At first, it was shallow, just enough to sting. But as he dragged the knife deeper, the searing pain became unbearable. Tears streamed down my face as he worked, carving the letters of his name into my forearm like it was nothing more than a piece of paper. Blood dripped onto the floor, pooling between us. "See," he said, stepping back to admire his handiwork. "Now you're mine, forever." The pain blurred my vision, but I refused to cry out. I wouldn't give him that satisfaction. Hours passed. He slapped me when I didn't respond fast enough and shoved me against the wall when I tried to resist. At one point, he dragged me into the bathroom. My wrists were bound with duct tape and he turned the shower on ice cold, shoving me under the spray. The water hit like needles, stealing my breath and leaving me shaking violently.
"Cleans you up," he muttered. "Gotta keep things neat."
Back in the bedroom, he tied me to the bed, cuffing my hands to the frame and securing my ankle to the post. My arm throbbed where he'd carved his name, the cut still raw and bleeding.
"Take this," he said, forcing a pill into my mouth. "You'll sleep."
When he finally fell asleep beside me, snoring softly, I forced myself to move. My head swam from the drugs, but I couldn't give in to the fog. Slowly, I pulled my hands toward my mouth, twisting my wrists just enough to bring the cuff clasp to my teeth. The metal was cold, the screw impossibly small, but I worked at it, bit by bit. Minutes stretched into an eternity, then the clasp gave way. My hands were still cuffed, but I could move them freely. Carefully, I untied the rope from my ankle. My movements were slow and deliberate, every tiny sound amplified in the silent room. When I finally stood, my heart was pounding so hard I thought it might wake him. I turned toward the door but stopped when I saw the closet. Its accordion-style doors were open just enough to catch my attention. I shouldn't have looked. Inside, piles of dresses were heaped together. They weren't ordinary clothes. Bloodstains streaked the fabric, dark and dried, some barely visible and others glaring under the dim light. My breath caught in my throat, and panic clawed at me. These dresses didn't belong to me. They belonged to others. Other girls. I didn't wait a second more, and ran straight to the main road. Once outside, the cool night air hit me, and I broke into a run. A car approached, and I flung myself in front of it, waving my arms wildly. The driver slammed on the brakes.
"Help me,"
I gasped.
"Been kidnapped. Take me to the cops."
On June 24, 2002, Richard Ivonitz abducted 15-year-old Kara Robinson from a friend's yard in Greenville, South Carolina. He got out of his car and approached her, pretending to offer her some pamphlets. After she said her friend's parents were not home, Ivonitz held a gun to her neck and then forced her into a plastic bin. He took her to his apartment where he tortured her for 18 hours. Brave Kara Robinson managed to free herself and then escape while Ivonitz was asleep. She went outside and found two men in a car and they took her to the sheriff's office. Later that day, Ivonitz was surrounded by police, where he passed away after realizing he has been caught.